telemarketing in the capacity of a joint venture coordinator or organizer or facilitator. Their first job is to facilitate joint ventures.
Okay.
Once they facilitate them, then the question is how many different products or services or promotions can you do through that contact they have established? Once you've done all that is practical for you, then their job becomes different. Their job is then to go and develop other joint ventures with other people, but also to find other companies, products, or services you could put through that pipeline you've established with the joint venture partner. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it may be even that as they joint venture with this person, it will become kind of apparent who else would be able to use the situation.
For example, I used to buy, I would go to newsletters and sell them on the fact that they had the opportunity to do so much with their inserts that they didn't. I'd get them starting to do things with me with my products. When that worked, I would have a contingent agreement from them that if our relationship worked, I would have the right to bring to them all kinds of other products and services, and we would split profits. So I could go out to all kinds of other companies who produce really noteworthy products or services and make deals with them to use their products in that pipeline, and I would profit greater from other people than I did myself.
Okay, how about another example from somewhere out of the print business, the more tangible business? Anything pop to mind?
Sure. I was in the 8-track tape business years ago.
Okay.
When I was in the 8-track tape business, I would go to all kinds of fast, quick markets like 7-Eleven. I think they have 7-Elevens almost everywhere, don't they?
Right.
At 7-Eleven, I would get them to put my 8-track rock and country tapes in their facility on a consignment basis. They would basically agree to do that. I won their trust. They'd put them in, and every week I'd make them $300 to $400 to $500. After I had done that and predictably performed for a few months, I went to them and I asked them to let me bring them other items, and I would bring them other kinds of impulsive things we would put on their counters that they would sell. We did something with ashtrays one time. We did things with stress reduction, self-diagnostic. I was able to utilize the previous effort I had made many times over. Most people establish a relationship with a company, and then all they do is sell their product. That's a waste, because once I have your goodwill, I could introduce you to all kinds of other appropriate products or services you could benefit from, and you would probably give me the benefit of trusting me and giving it a try, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So you can make more. It's a function of the philosophy of profitization. I think profiting is a function of finding the greatest way to benefit the other side. It doesn't necessarily mean that the greatest way is going to be your product or service, although your product or service may be the entree that you use.
Okay.
Who cares
okay.
how you make your money as long as you do make your money?
Okay, yeah. And that comes from thinking about the other person and thinking in terms of the customer.
That is correct.
Okay.
The next category, we're still in this first growth area of how to grow your customers, is running special events or information nights. On one of the previous sessions, I summarized an article that was in Australia from a company that had a different event every day of every week of every month of every year.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
I remember.
And I would recommend to everybody listening, it doesn't matter how conservative or untraditional it might be, have special events. Distinguish people or occurrences. If you got good things, use that as a vehicle. If there's something new happening, use that as a basis for a promotion. If you haven't done anything for a long time, make that a basis. If you're in trouble, make that a basis. Any problem you have in your business can be a basis for a special event. Getting to know our customers, getting rid of the problems, unloading night, let people come and tell you what's wrong. I mean, it doesn't matter. You need basis to get people excited. Have special events and information nights. When you have new products, invite people to come. Send them information. Call them up behind. Use your telemarketer so it's a continuity-based, integrated, systematized process. Make it exciting. Make yourself distinctive. Make it valuable. Make it invaluable. Keep in mind, today, more than ever before, we are prevailed upon by so many people. Marty, I'm stopping and breaking. I have so many joint ventures going, I can't even remember all of them. I have so many people wanting to do things with me. I don't even remember half of their names. I don't remember all the things I got to do. Breaking through my miasma, getting my attention, takes something very special. Make parts of your business. Make events. Make products or services. Make occurrences. Make relationships special, and you will generate a great reward for yourself for doing it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, acquire qualified lists. This works whether you telemarket, whether you direct mail, whether you visit. Know who and where your best target prospects are. It's scary. I'll bet 95% of the people listening to this tape have not the slightest idea very specifically and definitively where the bulk of their best target prospective customers or new customers lie. I mean, they can say, yeah, they're, you know, upward mobile, 50 and above, making 100,000, whatever that, but most of them could not for the life of themselves tell you exactly where those people are, who they are by name, by business, by locale, by phone number, by decision maker. Until and unless you get that radar targeted, you'll never maximize your selling opportunities. So you got to work to start acquiring qualified lists of your best prospective new customers. You get those by compiling, by calling the yellow pages, by getting list brokers to assemble them, by going to organizations or associations or magazines or all kinds of groups that have known facets that show you what your people, how to reach your people. If you know that everybody you want probably drives a Mercedes or a BMW or a Porsche, you need lists of BMW and Mercedes and Porsche owners. If you know everybody that you want to reach is a chemical engineer, you probably want a list of all the chemical engineers. But if you just basically ad hoc sort of call blindly, do you see that you can't possibly get maximum efficiency?
Yeah. I
had a very good story until I have a son who used to sell copiers for a prominent copying company. And his territory was an industrial part of Los Angeles. And I'd have these really fascinating discussions. He'd go door to door just knocking coldly on business after business. And I said, honey, I think you're wasting about 90% of your time. He said, Dad, what do you mean? I said, well, first thing I would do if I were you is I'd look at what your company knows to be the 5 or 10 highest probable businesses to buy copiers. In other words, if there's 100 industries, there's probably 10 industries that are 10 times more probable.
Yeah, makes sense.
I'd say I'd find out what they were and then where they were, meaning how many of those were in your territory, and I would organize those to be the first calls I would make.
Right.
Why would you want to spend 90% of your time on businesses that are 1/10 as probable buyers if you could spend 100% of your time on the ones that are 10 times more? I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Did he listen to Dad?
He did, and it made a very big difference in his income. But his company didn't pay to do it. He had to do it on his own time. They didn't have enough interest, a big billion-dollar company. I can't tell you their name because it would embarrass them.
No kidding.
No kidding. So acquire targeted lists. When you get the lists, work them, mail them, visit them, call them, send them things. Do whatever it takes to maximize the worth. If you don't have the personnel, make joint ventures with other people who are calling on them. Find out who already has relationships. But you can't maximize your profits, your sales, your business successes until you first know who and where your very best stream and targeted group of customers lies. Don't you think?
Yes, that makes great sense.
Okay, the next one is develop a unique selling proposition. We've talked about this on two or three different sessions of the Wizard's Edge, but let's talk about it on a fourth one. It is imperative that you, for once and for all, determine what it is or what it can be about your business that singles it out more favorably in the eyes of your customer, that holds greater advantage, that makes them want to deal with you instead of your competitors. It can't be self-serving on your part. You've got to define, you've got to communicate, you've got to telegraph, not just in your selling words, but in every other aspect of your business, what your unique selling proposition is going to be. And it's got to be something or some combination of things that your competitors don't currently offer Or if they offer it, they don't really promote, so that you seem to be preemptively superior in benefit to your customer. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Okay, let's go through it. And then let me tell you why. In other words, if there's 20 people, what I'm trying to do is give you the nuances that make even nothing more than the law of averages work for you. Mm-hmm. If there's 20 competitors and all 20 are calling on the same 1,000 prospects with the same miserably ineffective presentation, mm-hmm. and your USP is that we basically deliver free and we've got three times the guarantee and we don't consider any purchase binding until you've had it for 30 days and no one else says that, what do you think your advantage is if that's all you do, is if that's the only single difference that you have?
Even if you deliver the message poorly,
if you bumble it, you still got an advantage. That's what any one of these gives you massive distinction and advantage. That's all I'm trying to do, is give you easy advantage.
Okay. All right, Jay, where are we at here in the first box?
Oh, about halfway.
About halfway. We have about a third of the program left. I am real curious about any leverage point from the book that you talked about. And to be honest, I'm kind of dying to know those money-making ideas you have.
Yeah, well, let's do this. Why don't I summarize a little bit this book, and then I'll get into 5 or 6 or 12 or whatever number of money-making ideas we can. And the nice thing about it is it's taken everybody 5 or 10 or 20 years to get where they are. In the last year or so, we've probably grown them so massively, and in the next year or so, we'll grow them even more. I mean, I wish that they were sitting in front of me and I had all day and all night to spend just pontificating. I don't really do that, but I think we're trying to condense and compact the most usable and application-specific ideas and strategies for them. I want to give them all these other ideas, but any one of the things we covered today or in the last session, I hope they understand, changing that alone could give them, 10 or 15% improvement in profit could be very meaningful to about anybody, but we've probably given them today, if they just do. I mean, I've got so much more that we'll get on the next call or the next conversation we have, but just this alone is probably worth tens or multiples of tens of thousands of dollars to anybody who will take action on.
Well, it's almost like you've given us some tools that almost make the difference between light and dark.
It should be like it, what it must have been like in the heyday of the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, the idea of everyone else is basically riding a horse and you're driving a Model T.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty interesting analogy. Oh, yeah, let me tell you about Claude Hopkins. May I?
Yeah, please do.
Claude Hopkins is a mentor of mine, vicarious. He was long dead before I was ever introduced to him. I was introduced to him by a man who used the elements and the fundamentals of his teachings to create 4 $100 million enterprises. He gifted me by telling me and introducing me to Claude. I had no idea Claude existed. He single-handedly put his imprimatur on more overnight and rapid successes in the American business scene than about any man known alive. He was a master of the full, complete context of marketing. He was incredible in his fanaticism of researching and identifying little advantages that gave companies distinction and competitive edges against everyone else in their industries. He lived at a time when he had to understand human nature at a high level. He spawned massive, massive successes. He got Schlitz from number 9 to number 1 in about 6 months. He created Colgate Palmolive. He created ads for 5 or 6 automobiles that made them the preeminent leaders in their field. He did financial services. He did pharmaceuticals, patent medicine. He did all kinds of things. His name was Claude Hopkins, Claude E. Hopkins. He wrote 2 books. One is called Scientific Advertising. The other is called My Life in Advertising. My Life in Advertising is his biography. Scientific Advertising is a distillation summation of basically his principles. I have a bunch of notes I will refer to that I keep in my drawer whenever I get off my mark and need to get my mental acuity intensified and realigned. Please bear with me. It's a summary of the most important ideas from his book, and I'll just distill them in their core essence. Try to super condense them so you can at least catch the spirit. We learn the principles of effective marketing and prove them by repeated tests through key measured advertising and by traced returns, largely coupons or key numbers. We can compare one method with many others and record the results. invariably, one method, one approach, one strategy of doing things or saying things or positioning things or pricing things will outproduce the others by massive differences. Once one method proves best, that method becomes a fixed principle, and we automatically move to implement that throughout our system. Advertising is nothing more than salesmanship, and its principles are the principles of salesmanship. Successes and failures are due to similar causes in selling and in advertising. Every advertising question should be answered by the same standard you impose on a salesman, not by conjecture. Too many people are intimidated by letters, by sales letters, by advertisements, by commercials. They're nothing more than selling messages, and the same rigors, the same disciplines, the same questions, the same demands you would impose on your salesperson is what you should do on your advertisement. The only purpose of an advertisement is to make sales or to produce a prospect. It is profitable or unprofitable according to the sales or the prospective generating results it engenders. Its purpose is not for general effect. It is not to keep your name before the people. It is not to entertain. It is not to take up wasted space or time. It is not to disrespect the listener or the reader or the recipient. It is not primarily to aid your other salespeople. It's designed to support its efforts on its own. It's designed to justify its existence. Treat advertising as you would a salesman or woman. Force it to justify itself. Compare it with other salespeople. Figure its cost and its results. Accept no excuses, which good salesmen do not make. In other words, if there's not a reason it didn't work, don't tolerate ever using it again. Demand so much more from your advertisements because they can give that to you. The difference is only in degree. Advertising is salesmanship multiplied. It may appeal to thousands while the salesman talks to one, but it involves a corresponding cost, and you are communicating one-on-one. It's being listened to or read or seen by one man or woman at a time. Some people spend $10 per word on an average ad. Therefore, every ad should be a super salesman. A lot of people spend a lot more of that on words in electronic advertising.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting stuff, isn't it, Marty?
Yeah, I never thought about that. Per word cost.
A salesman's mistake may cost little. An advertising mistake may cost 1,000 times as much. Be even more cautious and more exacting with your advertisement than you ever would be with your sales force. People don't take advertising or direct mail communication with the same level of importance. If you had a sales force, you wouldn't let them haphazardly go out and do whatever they want and work whenever they want and say whatever they want and price things whatever they want, would you?
I think that's incredibly unlikely.
Yeah, but most people are so intolerant and undemanding of their advertising or selling approaches because they allow themselves to be unduly intimidated by the genre. It's not hard to understand.
Okay.
There's one simple and right way to answer many advertising questions. Ask yourself this. Would this help a salesman sell the goods? Would it help me sell the goods if I met the buyer in person? Would it help the buyer buy the goods? Would it help the buyer see the benefit? Some people say, be very brief. People will read very little. Would you say that to a salesman? With a prospect standing before him, would you confine him to a certain number of words? That would be an unthinkable handicap.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it, Marty.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say, knock on a door, get into an office, get on the phone, get a prospective buyer on the phone, and then you got all of 17 words that you can say, then you got to get off.
Not something you'd want to do.
So it is in advertising. The only readers you get are people whom are subject interests. Long or short, no one reads ads for amusement. Think of your readers as prospects standing before you, seeking self-serving information. Give them enough to get them to act. Don't think of people in the mass. That gives you a blurred view. Think of a typical individual who's likely to want what you sell. Don't try to be amusing, Marty. Do just what you think a good salesman should do with a half-sold person before him. And I'm using man just as a reference, or saleswoman. trying to be sexist or discriminating. Remember that the people you address are selfish. We all are, Marty. They care nothing about your interests or your profit. They seek service and value and benefit and advantage for themselves. Ignoring this fact is common and costly to you. It's a very costly mistake in advertising, Marty. The worst ads ask no one to buy. That is useless. Often they don't even quote a price. They don't say that dealers handle the products and direct you to them. Be sure all your information in any ad you run or pay money investing on is complete and correct. Lead the prospect to the sale. The best ads are based entirely on service to the customer or the reader. They offer wanted information. By the way, this is the same thing with sales presentations and direct mail, so it doesn't matter. It's all the same. Do you understand that?
Right. It can be applied in multiple ways.
They offer wanted information. They cite advantages to users. Perhaps they offer to send a sample on approval to the customer so they can test, so the customer can use it for a period of time without having the purchase be binding. These ads may seem altruistic, but they are based on the keenest understanding and respect and knowledge of human nature. The writers know how people are led to buy, the writers of these kind of ads. Here again is salesmanship. The good salesman does not merely cry out a name. He doesn't say, buy my article. He pictures the customer side of the transaction and the customer's demand, and desire for service until the natural result is to buy. The difference between advertising and salesmanship lies largely in personal contact. The salesman is there to demand attention. He cannot well be ignored, but the advertising can be ignored. The salesman wastes much of his time on prospects whom he can never hope to interest. He cannot pick them out. The advertisement, if their headline is done correctly, is read only by interested people who, of their own volition, have studied what we have to say and picked themselves out. They self-selected. Everyone reading it is a prime prospect. You owe it to yourself to make the most compelling, the most self-serving, the most inducive, the most call-to-action-based offer when you get the chance. The purpose of a headline is to pick out people you can interest. If you wish to talk to someone in a crowd, the first thing you say is, hey there, Bill Jones, to get the right person's attention. It's the same way in advertisements. What you have will interest only certain people and for certain reasons. You care only for those people. Create a headline which will hail those people only. Not so simple, but it's overlooked by almost everybody, don't you think, Marty?
Yeah,
interesting,
it is.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is.
Human nature is the same today as it was in the time of Julius Caesar. The principles of psychology are fixed and enduring. You will never need to unlearn what you learn about them, Marty. Platitudes and generalities roll off human beings or human understanding like water off a duck. They leave no impression whatsoever. Hyperbole, platitudes, generalities. To say best in the world or lowest price in existence is at best simply claiming the expected. But superlatives of that sort are usually damaging. They suggest looseness of expression, a tendency to exaggerate, a carelessness of truth. They lead readers to discount all the statements that you make. But a man who makes a specific claim, Marty, is either telling the truth or a lie. People do not expect an advertiser to lie. They know that they can't lie in the best mediums. The growing respect for advertising has largely come through a growing regard for its truth. So a definite statement is usually accepted. Actual figures are not generally discounted. Measurement and comparability that is definitive is usually respected. Specific facts stated in written or personal salesmanship carry their full weight and effect. The weight of an argument may often be multiplied by making it specific.
Okay. Jay, we've got about 15, 20 minutes left.
Yes.
This is intriguing information.
I've got about 7 more minutes with this, maybe less.
All right. Why don't you go ahead and finish that up?
Yeah, I promise everybody. As I said, I'm going to be here next month, the next month, the next month. We got a lifetime worth of knowledge. I mean, I spent 25 years learning this. I'm trying to condense a lot of it. This book has made me literally $10 million, so it might be worth taking a few more minutes.
Okay.
I mean, I know we're going to give them ideas, but this is a master philosophy that you can integrate into everything. I'm sure you've already gotten about 10 ideas listening, haven't you?
Yeah, I have.
I was talking about the weight of an argument, but maybe multiplied by making it specific. For example, say that a tungsten lamp gives more light than a carbon one, and you leave some doubt. Say that it gives 3 1/3 times the light, and people realize that you have made tests in comparison. Whatever claim you use to gain attention, the advertisement should tell a reasonably complete story. By the way, all this applies to salesmanship. So anyone listening saying, I don't advertise, stop. You send letters to people, prospects, confirmations, proposals. You visit people. People visit you. You deal with people on the telephone. There's not one element of this that I've just read that doesn't translate to salesmanship because they're the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
When you once get a person's attention, that is the time to accomplish all you ever hoped to with him. Bring all the good arguments to bear. Cover every phase of your subject. One fact appeals to some, another to others. Omit any one, and a certain percentage of people will lose the face which might have convinced them. Almost any question about your advertising campaign can be answered cheaply, quickly, and finally by a test campaign, and that's the way to answer them, not by arguments around a table. Go to the court of last resorts whenever you have a question. The court is the buyers of your product. Don't ask people to vote by questioning them. Ask them to vote with their wallets. A person who wants to make an impression must stand out from the masses in a pleasing and advantageous way. Being eccentric or abnormal is not a distinction to covet, but doing admirable things in a different way gives one a great advantage. So it is with salesmen, in person or in print. There is uniqueness which belittles and arouses resentment. There is refreshing uniqueness which enhances, which we welcome and we remember. We give each advertiser a becoming style. We make him distinctive, perhaps not in appearance, but in manner and in tone. He is given an individuality best suited to the people he addresses. One man appears rugged and honest in a line where rugged honesty counts. I'm going to stop there, okay?
Okay.
What do we have, about 10 minutes?
About 10, 15 minutes. Whenever we talk, I feel like I could, like, take about 5 minutes of your instruction, your ideas shared, and basically spend the rest of the week applying that.
Well, I'm trying to dole out in a systematic way a foundation of living your business and your personal life. I'm trying to give you all the connections, Marty, that make being successful easier than being unsuccessful, that make having great fun and joy and being afforded great joy by others easier to reap than not. I'm trying to give you a way to basically have such a perpetual life advantage over everybody else you ever compete against in business and your personal life and have connections at a higher level. And I think too many people have allowed the process to become far too complex or protracted. It ain't that hard. It really isn't that hard, Marty.
Okay. Now, having talked about that, you have to admit, and I know you've had clients like this, that we'd really like to have just some idea that we could run out and do and make some quick money, easy money, whatever the right term would be.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me give you a couple of – I'll give you some stream of consciousness, and I'll go through some other things. First thing is, from today forward, everybody that's got any customers – in 90% of the businesses listening to this tape have probably a high 10 or a 100,000 plus stored jackpot windfall just by setting up a regular formalized referral process. What I want you to do for the next 2 days as an experiment is the following. Every customer, active or inactive, that you deal with in the next 2 days, directly by letter, whatever, I want you to try a little experiment. Tell them that you just made an embarrassing realization and you'd like very much to apologize and also to prevail upon them. You realize, basically, that you spend more of your time than you want to out in the outside market trying to build new customers for your business, and that costs effort, time, and precious capital. That's not the best use of your time. The best use of your time is working harder to serve the needs of your customers, learning more, discovering more, researching more products, gaining more technical skill, whatever the application is. The only way you can afford to do that is if you can take lesser amounts of your time and capital that you're currently devoting to selling and instead devote it to do what's going to bring greater advantage to your customer. The best way to do that, you just realized, is that your existing customers are probably the greatest source of future business imaginable because they hang out, they associate, they deal with, they buy from, and they sell to the very exact quality of people you want. So you're asking a favor of them that will repay itself many times over in greater benefit to them. You're asking them in the next week if they would do you the courtesy and pick out two people they know in their blank, business, life, neighborhood, job, whatever is applicable, who would benefit as much as they already have by having your product or service or company serving them. And you want to ask those people to either come in or call in or schedule an appointment with you. And because of the fact that most people need direction, you're going to tell them the following, Marty. Here's what the people will probably be looking like. You want to help them paint a picture. They're either, and you got to figure it out based on your business, they're either in this business or this age or this locale or doing this or needing this, or this has either just happened or going to happen in their life. And you paint pictures of who they are and what's transpired or going to transpire so they see suitability.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's one thing you do. If you do that, I've done it. In probably 100 fields, it has never failed, if executed properly, to produce within about a week a massive influx of new business. I would say almost anybody who's got any goodwill in their customers would be able to bring in many thousands, maybe tens of thousands of dollars from this within 5 days. And you can do it for weeks and weeks and weeks until you hit saturation. Once you hit saturation, meaning you've done it to all your customers, you can do it again with a different rationale, and all new customers coming in, the ones they refer to you, you start telling them that from now on, the basis we do business is all new customers, we want to serve you at a level you can't believe. We want to spend all our time and our effort doing the things that will make our product and service more valuable. We don't want to spend all our time running ads and calling on people and selling and soliciting. So we require that all new customers, in order to deal with us and get the best possible service we can give them, agree within the first 3 months to refer to us directly at least two customers, and you'll set up a self-perpetuating process.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. Call every competitor. If you'll start a process of calling every competitor, two things will happen. You'll befriend a lot of people who are at various parts in their life where it might be incredible opportunities that will manifest themselves for you. Number one, some of them will be at a point where they're ready to sell their business, and you'll be in a position, if you listen to all the recommendations I make, to take over their assets without any cash and make yourself a lot of money and make them a lot of money and turn enemies into allies. Number two, a lot of your competitors reject certain kinds and types of businesses or prospects or sizes of transactions because they're not set up for them. You might be, by having relationships with all your competitors and having them understand that they can refer certain kinds of business to you, and you can make a deal to either, A, not take other kinds of business from those customers, or, you know, integrate them in. Every piece of referral that they give you from somebody they refuse or they turn down, you'll pay them a perpetual piece on. I had a software company one time that only sold $10,000 and above types of software. About 80% of the calls they got from their advertisements were people who had who wanted $2,000 and $1,000 pieces of software, and they would just refuse them. I got them to refer that to their competitor who had other kinds of lower-priced software. They ended up making more from the referrals than they did from the people that they sold to.
Maybe a person could generate a business that was so high-ticket that he wouldn't have any business but could make money on the referrals.
I absolutely agree. That's true. Borrow ideas continuously. If every day, you instead of eating lunch, you go out and you buy a sandwich or something quick, and you use the hour to go to other businesses outside of your company and let them try to sell you, and you pose as if you're a customer, I guarantee you every day you'll get one selling technique that will make you at least $1,000.
Okay.
Just by finding what they do and modifying it to yourself.
Hmm.
Look at every problem in your business right now. Make a list of every problem and turn every one of those into a basis for a communication to your customers, a sale, a promotion, a can you help me, I'm so exasperated I needed a friend to talk to. Just find it, turn every negative in your business into a selling opportunity to communicate with your customer.
Mm.
Repeat your overlooked successes. I shudder to tell you the story, but it's happened about 20 times, so I know it's got to be replicated in the people listening here. I do a lot of work with real estate agents. I was on a call about 2 weeks ago. I was trying to show them instant leverage. Everyone was trying to make it so hard. They want new ways to make money. I said, well, let's just see what's already working for you. I interviewed about a dozen people. I said, well, tell me how you do your business right now. And almost half of them had a similar story. They farmed an area. There was a target area that they worked. And what it meant was every month or every 2 months, they would mail blank letters. In one case, it was 500 targeted homes that they would mail a letter or a postcard to every 2 months. Whenever they did that letter, it would produce roughly $10,000 worth of commission to them in a month.
Okay.
And they wanted new programs. And I said, well, just wait. I said, are there only 500 people in your city? And they said, no. And I said, well, it would seem to me that, first of all, to mail 500 letters, Marty, cost $250, right?
Right.
50 cents a piece.
Right.
I said, well, so what you're telling me is every time you spend $250, you generate $10,000 a month, right?
Right.
And I said, and you're telling me there's far more than 500 people in your neighborhood, or in your area, right?
Right.
I said, well, it just seems like two simple solutions. You don't mail 500 letters. You start mailing 1,000 letters. You take, you take an extra $250 out of that $10,000 you made last month, and instead of going out to dinner twice, you put it in the mail. And all of a sudden you make $20,000, and you mail the letter more often. And they couldn't say no, and they went out and did it, and guess what? It worked. So the point is, look at what has already worked that you haven't done to the maximum. Certain people will do a mailing three times a year or once a year to their customers, and it'll pull like, man, that's all they'll do. Because there is no because. They just do it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's the cutting off of the roast out of tradition, the story you told, I think, maybe in our first program.
Exactly. It's pretty funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
I want everybody on this call to start for the next month until they get from me another issue of The Edge. I want them to send at least a press release a day to some organization that is appropriate. And they got to understand, a press release is nothing more than finding an application of your business or a product in your business or a service of your business or something fascinating about what your business is doing that is newsworthy to some segment of the media. And it could be if you're a retailer, you send it to every little publication, every radio station. It can't be that you're in business. It can't be that you open a new store. That's nothing. But if you found a fun way of doing something, if you're selling something unique, if people are buying something for you for another business, if you sell 25 times as many because you found a way for people to get excited about it, you got to find a twist. You got to find a twist. If I can do it in one of the sessions, a good friend of mine is the former PR director for Capitol Records, and he's the one that orchestrated the Beatles tour of the United States, and he's a master person at explaining the nuances of PR in about 13 minutes or less, and I'll try to get him on one of these calls with us and interview him.
Sounds super.
But if you just send, I just got a letter from a client who told me that he tried what I said, and he got 25 publications to write about him, and he's gotten so much business for nothing, and he's gotten so much notoriety, and then he uses all the press releases. He publishes, and he sends them out to people. He publishes them in his office. He sends them in books that his salespeople show to people. It gives credibility and perceived distinction to him. How are we on time?
Give me another minute and a half.
Okay. At year end, if you have made a lot of money, the greatest way to mitigate that money from a tax standpoint is to spend it on programming that will bring new customers in January and February. So you can do a tax-based promotion. If you haven't made a lot of money, but you have made some money, you can do what I call the tax problem letter. You write a letter to all your customers tied into a special event or a sale or an advantage, and you say, I have a tax problem, and I'd rather you be the beneficiary instead of the IRS. You tell them how you've made a certain amount of money this year, not massive, but enough that you're going to owe a reasonable amount of taxes, more than you like. Those dratted tax collectors have got such an oppressive and confiscatory structure. You have two choices. Pay it and see it go to an uncaring, frittering, frivolous, fiscally imprudent government, or invest it in customers by mailing this letter and letting you buy stuff from me for basically little over cost, because if I make any more money this year, I'll just have to pay more taxes. I'd rather bring you back into my business or introduce you to a new product eliminate the profit this one time because it doesn't do me any good to make a lot of profit in December because I'm going to have to pay it to the government. I'd rather get you in, start a buying relationship, or start you on a new product that will benefit you so I'll make money next year.
All right, Jay, we're out of time. How about a 30-second motivation to go out there and do some of this before we go?
Everything I have shared today and in every other session of The Edge is real-world, proven, profit-certain, success-predictable, enjoyable as can be, techniques, philosophies, strategies I have mastered in the real world. They are techniques that are universal. You have to get a little comfortable to execute, but they cost virtually nothing in time, very little in money, very little more effort. My take is this. In business, you have three choices. You either accept getting very little yield out of your time, you decide you want far more yield from the time you're in, or you decide you want the same yield for half the time and you want to direct your time to more plentiful and worthwhile purposes. But I don't want to work with people who are content basically beating their head against the wall and getting a minimal of outcome. Anybody who wants either more yield for the time or the same yield for a fraction of the time, this stuff works. Just give it a chance and let the results prove themselves.
Jay Abraham with the Wizard's Edge. Jay, thanks for this month. We'll look forward to next month. You keep working.
Thanks, Marty.
This is Marty Stacey saying thanks for listening to the Wizard's Edge. Bye-bye for now.
Abraham, Jay, you have certainly positioned yourself in the business world as one of the premier advisors for people with businesses, successful businesses that want to become more successful. You have a real gift at helping people see opportunities in their business or in their particular market and to take advantage of those opportunities and become much more profitable. And you spend a lot of time giving seminars and producing packages and so forth to help people achieve this. Now, today, though, I'm going to kind of try to push you back maybe 20 years or 25 years in your own life to talk today about what are the real motivations, what are the benefits for a person who has not yet started a business but who is thinking about the need for starting a business given the extremely risk-oriented position anybody's in who's dependent upon a salary. Let's talk a little about what it takes in terms of motivation, in terms of skill and the rest of it. What does it take for a person to begin to make that first leap into independency and into financial security, but beginning then to abandon his dependence upon a paycheck? What does it take for a guy to be successful?
Well, I think, Gary, it takes a couple things. First of all, a recognition of the fact that all security really is the faith, the confidence, and the trust you've got in yourself and your ability to perform. Second, I think it needs a transition mentally to where you realize that compensation, that value in life and business has nothing to do with hours. It has nothing to do with time. It has only to do with what kind of results you can contribute to society, to business, to individuals. And when you recognize those factors, it sets up the stage for you to break away from your preconceived notions, because most people who've spent most of their lives working in a structured, salary-based, corporate or factory-based environment, the system has pretty much imposed upon them a mental paradigm, which is basically their thinking box. It says, you have to work 8 hours. You are worth $20 an hour. You need to be directed by somebody else. You are a chain in the link, so to speak. And I think you got to break away from that and say, I can. Not first thing you got to say, I can add value to business or people's lives or situation, or I can save people from danger, or I can enhance the process of something. And you got to start thinking about in terms of that. Independent business owners and professionals, people in their own businesses sustain themselves by increasing the quality or protecting the circumstances of people or businesses' lives, don't you think?
Sure.
Okay, so the next thing you've got to realize, I mean, from my vantage point, the opportunity and also the mistake, you got to look at two things. The mistake people make is trying to, what I'll call, pole vault into independence. I think that there's a safer hedge. I like the escalator theory, where you do things safe and in short little steps. So what you want to ask yourself is, what has the highest probability of working, of making me money? And I go through a matrix, depending on who you are and what you are. The first thing I always do is look within your own situation. You look within your current employee or your past employee and say, what about that could I get involved with and add more value? And you got to interpret value. Value could be adding more productivity, adding more safety. A lot of people that I've worked with in the earlier stages of my life, we showed them how to go to their employers or go to their ex-employers or go to people in the same industry they used to be employed in and help those people perform certain processes in the business cycle either more effectively or more economically or more profitably or more appropriately, and charge them either a fee or a percentage of the savings, profit, whatever, and start themselves into business with a cash flow that had no dependency whatsoever on time. Let me give you an example. I have had people who work for a company who, let's say that they were a salesperson in a company, and they were a top salesperson in that company, and they made three or four times what all the other salespeople in the company average. I have counseled with them and shown them how, instead of just being a salesperson, they could go to their company or they could go to competitors to their company or anybody else selling a similar type of product and teach their sales abilities, their sales system to any of those people for either fees or for percentages or for combinations. And I've taken people who used to basically make just a salary or a commission and show them how to get fee income from their employers, their competitors, their employers' competitors, and people in all kinds of kindred ways. We've had people who were very good in the management function. They may have worked for a company and helped that company eliminate a lot of unnecessary overhead or expense items and just get a salary. They either get outplaced when a company wound down or just be frustrated because they weren't being paid enough. We've taught them how to go first and foremost to their company and tell them they were quitting, but that they would do the same service for their company for a fee or a fee plus some kind of a bonus that was correlated to savings. And if their company would not employ them, we've taught them how to go to their company's competitors. And every other kind of business that had similar aspects where this person's expertise could bring advantage. For example, we knew somebody who was a master at cutting phone bills. He did it for his company. He was paid like $50,000. We taught that person how to go to all kinds of other companies in that industry and similar and do it for them, but not just as a salaried employee. Instead, for a minimum fee plus a percentage of the savings for a duration of time. He ended up making multiples upon multiples. We took a man who worked for a catalog company, and he was a good employee. He ran a very large multi-million dollar catalog company. He was being paid $80,000 a year and hated it. I found out that what his skill sets were, about 1,000 other smaller catalog companies would love to have had, but they couldn't afford to pay $80,000. But they could easily afford to pay retainer fees of $10,000, particularly broken up $800 or $900 a month. I got him to go and find himself 20 different companies who would pay him retainers just to share the wisdom he had already perfected and used in his salary job. And he instantly went from being shackled to a job to being independent, working only half the time and making $250,000 and having about 10 times more freedom and respect. But it's a way of looking at what your skill sets are. Most people have an enormously greater level of skill sets and knowledge than they realize. But when you work for somebody, it's a very interesting dynamic. Companies acknowledge you, but they don't really go out of their way to have you realize the value you really contribute to the business. But from a practical standpoint, in today's society, Gary, if you stay on the payroll,
really bring a lot of value to that company, because companies are very, very parsimonious today. They're not keeping waste on their payroll. You know that.
Jay, I agree entirely with that. There is a problem that most people have who've been on somebody else's payroll too long, and that is a kind of built-in undervaluing of their own skills. And you've already said this in a very compelling way, but I think we have to look at the fear factor. You've shown why it is that they probably are more valuable than they think, but it's not just the knowledge that, well, yes, I probably am more valuable. The question in that person's mind is really twofold. First question is, can I find somebody else to pay me what I'm worth on a part-time basis? And the second question is, really and truly honest engine, I wonder how much I really am worth. And he doesn't really know, and so he's afraid to do what you've just said to do, that you have to go in and become an independent contractor. What are the kinds of things a person worries about where you've talked to these people, and you have talked to them? What are the resistance levels? Why are they there, and how did you persuade these people to overcome those resistance levels and take the plunge?
Well, I did it a number of different ways, and I'll give you a couple of strategies here. I'll give you some trial balloons people can try that don't require them to compromise the security or the deceptively elusive perception of security that they may have if they're employed. I'll presume that the person listening to this tape is either gainfully employed, out of work, retired, but at a point of flux in their life, right?
Right.
Okay. So, number one, what I try to do is, if you don't revere yourself and your worth, no one can. So the first thing I do is ask people a lot of questions to try to help them evolve to the place that they really respect what their value is. I ask them to go back in time and identify and write down what their skill sets are and what that means in a more tangible and transactional basis. For example, let's say that you have spent your whole life working in the quality control side of manufacturing. I would start asking a bunch of questions that would help you realize that you probably have developed systems and understandings that keep your employer producing their product at the lowest possible waste. And I'd ask what the waste used to be, and I'd have you walk through so where you realize I've eliminated 8% of waste, and I'd walk you through what they're spending on raw materials or components and show you that if the company employs you is spending $10 million a year on raw materials and they used to waste 8%, which is $800,000, and now because you've set up a system that only wastes 2%, you have saved that company $600,000. I get you to recognize your value is $600,000 a year to that business, and I get you to realize if you're being paid $50,000, you're probably being grotesquely underpaid for your value. Then I get you to see that that's probably not the only situation you could bring those kind of savings to. Then I get you to see that most companies, if you could bring them $600,000 savings, would be only too eager to pay you certainly a fee and possibly a fee plus or at least a share of those savings for a period of time, 1 year, 2 year, 5 years, forever. I'd walk you through that mental matrix so you got a belief in yourself and a recognition of the impact and implication you would make on somebody's business life. Once I did that, I then would, depending upon the kind of person you were, would advise, counsel, recommend, or direct you to either do some trial balloons to other businesses outside of your direct employer's generic field. In other words, if you are in the electronic manufacturing, but your skill set would have worked anywhere, I would take a kindred field that wasn't exactingly direct, and I'd have you try communicating either with letters or direct correspondence, either a meeting or a phone call. If you are not the kind of person who has a high perception of your own value, even though I've proven to you that you really add enormous contribution and value to your employer, I would suggest that you get a third party to represent you, an agent of sorts, and that man or woman be given the responsibility of negotiating in your behalf so that you only are brought in after they had set the stage, after they had qualified the candidate, after they had made the initial presentation, after they had gotten the discussion to a point where you were not born with the onerous responsibility of selling yourself. Some people are very good at selling themselves. You could do it, Gary, I could do it. Some people have enormous value, enormous expertise, enormous worth to businesses, but they don't have the capacity to advocate their own value. So that's no problem. Get someone else to do it. Give them a share of the results. It's what an agent does in Hollywood. If every actor and every actress and every producer and every director had to negotiate their own deal, there wouldn't be these multi-million-dollar deals. Actors would probably still be being paid $10,000, and directors wouldn't get creative control, and no one would get pieces of the deal because agents earn their value by adding value, by advocating and respecting and championing the transactional worth you may have. And so I would get people to use agents, if that makes sense.
In a particular industry, are agents fairly common?
No, but I mean, part of what I stand for is making your own rules. There is nothing. Salespeople are very common, aren't they?
Yes.
Aren't salespeople, in fact, agents for manufacturers?
That's correct.
It's not, all it is one slightly abstract dimension higher, isn't it?
Well, that's right.
Product. Your product happens to be an intangible. It's your worth. It's your expertise. I'm taking one scenario here. It's the one we started with. If you have abilities, I mean, if you look at engineers, if you look at consulting firms, that's all you are really is a consultant if you have expertise. Consulting firms, historically, even accounting firms, they have rainmakers. Rainmakers are salesmen or women. That's all. They go out and they qualify candidate prospects. They make presentations. They advocate the intangible value of their firm. They close the deal, and then the experts come in. Isn't that true?
That's right.
What's the difference if you have someone advocate and represent you? You call him or her an agent. They can be a representative. They can be a manager. They can be your sales representative. Who cares?
Actually, over the years, you have built up a whole list of people who do just exactly that, haven't you?
We have proteges, and I'm sure that we could find for people ones who could probably help them. If not, it's no big deal. What you do is, the trick is this. A lot of times people who are good salespeople have the same problem we're talking about. They don't realize that their sales ability is the real asset. It's not the product they're selling, and they get all confused. They think they need a great product. Really, they make good products great by their ability to advocate. So you find a salesman or woman or multiple salesmen or women, particularly ones who already have a presence in the industry and the area of the industry where you have your expertise, and you ask them basically to serve as your representative, to advocate, to extol the value. And what you've got to realize you're selling, you're not selling your expertise. You are selling the result, the tangible, meaningful, bottom-line result your expertise can make. You may have the ability to reduce somebody's inventory levels by 20%. Well, a company that maintains a $3 million inventory, if you can help them get $600,000 out of stagnancy and free up that capital, that's probably worth a lot. You may be able to reduce the amount of staff necessary to process something. If you can reduce overhead by 15 or 20%, any medium to large-sized company, that is a profound perpetual value. You've got to realize, first of all, what the long-term transactional implications of your ability or expertise are. And I defy anyone listening to this tape to not have at least one and oftentimes multiple expertises they've never recognized. Can't go through 20 years of doing something without having it. Some people have expertises that are actually more negotiable, Gary, outside of their business. Their hobby, their skills, their natural gifts are expertises that a lot of people would pay an enormous amount for. I knew somebody who was masterful at organization. He'd never been formally trained. He just was really organized. We got that person to teach individuals how to organize their personal lives. He made a wonderful living doing that. Not rich, but he wasn't interested in getting rich. He just wanted to do things he loved. It's finding what you do in your business, in your life, in your hobbies, in your natural God-given gifts, and finding a way to make that ability transferable to others. And if you're not comfortable advocating yourself, advocating the benefit that your gift or your skill set is worth, all you have to do is find a third party to do it for you. I mean, that's the whole system. If you look at American business, or if you look at world business, 90% of the people who own the enterprises couldn't sell their products or services if their lives depended on it. That's why they have sales forces, you know?
Jay, when a person is at that transitional stage,
yes,
probably... And I'm going to say probably, let's assume, I don't know for a fact, but let's assume the guy likes what he does, or he likes the results of what he does, but what he doesn't like is the structure that constrains him in the achievement of that goal. I mean, presumably he hasn't been out selling insurance his whole life, hating insurance. Boy, if he has, he better find something else to sell. But what he doesn't like are corporate restraints, or he doesn't like some aspect of the compensation system or whatever. Now, what you're talking about is a person who does really like what he wants to do. But more importantly, what he wants to do is find a way to do it, to do that thing that he wants, but that compensates him in a better way, or allows him more time, or releases him from the constraints of a corporate system that he doesn't respect. In other words, he's not going to continue doing something he hates. You're not telling a person to go on doing the rest of his life for something he hates, but to find a way to do it in a way that he likes.
I think I'm suggesting when you dispel your belief that time is what people pay for. The only time people pay for time is on a production basis. You know, you produce 100 widgets an hour, they'll pay you for 10 hours worth of productivity. Other than that, society really, even though society's never been challenged to acknowledge it, we're in a result-based world, aren't we? People don't pay just for time, they want a result. The first thing you've got to do is realize what within your skill set, what within your expertises, and everybody has expertises, do you do better than almost anybody else in the blank, in the company, in the industry, in the world? And it doesn't have to be limited to your job, but to start with your job. What have you done? It may be that you've been moved to something else, but that your real skill set, because of a miscarriage of sanity, the company took you from being the person that was able to orchestrate a $1 million a year's cost savings in one division, and they put you in a totally unrelated field, which you're frustrated in. But the fact of the matter is, over the last 10 years, that $1 million savings you were able to orchestrate is $10 million. There are a lot of enterprises today that would like to know how to cut $10 million out of their overhead over the next 10 years, don't you think?
Sure.
Start with what you're great at. And then the first thing I would say also is the odds are your own employer or past employers never fully recognize the value you contributed transactionally, because you probably never did. If you can't honestly say, I know that what I did made X, or saved X, or reduced overhead by X, or cut production time by X, or eliminated warehouse cost by X, or allowed us to operate from one half the space, thus saving annually X. If you can't say that, then you honest to goodness can't expect your current or your previous employers to say that. Until and unless you first recognize specifically on a tangible, measured, comparative basis what your value is, you're not in a position to demand and receive the fullest level of acknowledged compensation for it. Once you recognize it, the world literally can become your oyster.
It takes a certain mentality, a risk-oriented mentality for most people to begin to think this way. They're almost afraid to think this way, because I really think in the heart of an awful lot of people, they think, maybe I'm being overpaid. Maybe if I really found out what I'm worth, I'd find that I'm really not worth as much as the company is paying me. Now, what they haven't thought about is that companies don't pay a dollar an hour or $5 an hour to get $5 an hour of productivity back. Usually, they don't pay a dollar unless they can get at least $2 and maybe $3 back, because they're not in the charity business. So that the individual, as you say, has got to understand that he's worth a good deal more than his salary would indicate, precisely because the company wants some productivity in there and some hedge and some fat, basically, to protect its interest in paying you the 40 or 50 or 60 or whatever it is that that company's paying. Now, the problem, as you know, Jay, and as probably everybody listening to this tape knows, all of a sudden from around the world, we're getting new, very aggressive businesses forming from outside the United States that are coming in and really competing strongly against American firms. We have situation, for example, that I've come back to on several interviews, but I'm going to remind people because it's so important. In the field of engineering, you have people coming online through the internet in India, people with master's degrees in engineering who do speak English, sometimes even as a first language. These people are selling their engineering skills for $400 and $500 a month. And an American engineer who thinks he's worth $50,000 a year is now facing rigorous competition from outside the United States because of electronic communications. And this is forcing many, many large companies, the corporate master companies, the Fortune 500 companies, to scale back constantly on the number of employees that they've got on the books. Now, the reality is those employees who have not taken steps in advance to think about what they really are worth and to develop alternative ways of selling their talents, they're the ones who are really most vulnerable. It's the person who rationally calculates what he's worth to the company in advance of the pink slip and then begins to decide very forcefully and creatively, I think. He decides, I've got to find other purchasers of my skills to guarantee that I'm going to stay on this this paycheck and then finally escape from the paycheck. That's the more rational approach, because eventually the person who is not worth what he's getting paid is going to be found out and he's going to be fired, because tens of thousands of people almost every month are being fired who thought they were absolutely secure, but they aren't secure. Isn't that basically the crisis today?
Yeah, I think so. I think so, but I think that a lot of people, they do themselves, their employer, and society a disservice by disacknowledging their profound worth because they have a low self-image, because the system they have operated under so long has really, it's acknowledged disacknowledged you. They've paid them enough that you become a wage slave, so to speak, but not really ever, neither side has ever tried to really correlate and identify true worth. A salesman or woman is the closest thing to that, but even they don't really know true worth because most of them operate under whatever commission structure their employer wants to pay them, and the commission structure in no way, shape, or form correlates to real value. I've had a lot of salespeople who were great and had them go down the street and instead of working for somebody at 10% commission, find a manufacturer of a similar or a superior quality product, have them put their own label on it. Basically, instead of making 10%, make 210%, and all they had to do was finance the initial purchases and show them how to find somebody if they didn't have the wherewithal to do that, and all of a sudden their income would go up by 20 times by doing the same thing to the same people. They just have had a low self-image. I think we've allowed, it's almost hilarious, Gary, from my vantage point. We remind ourselves of the chicken, you know, the psychological example of the chicken who won't go over the fence, but the fence is not behind it or sideways. It just gets psychologically debilitated to believe that it's stuck in that non-existing compartment. It's, I think we've allowed ourselves to be constrained by delusion. We've always had, we always will, we currently have all controls once we stop abdicating them.
And what you're basically saying is get outside the psychological constraints for a time that you've been under for all these years, and think what you're really worth, which will probably be a lot larger than the constraints.
What you're worth and who would value it, and not just what you're worth this very moment, but go through. And my skill set has been that I've been able to capitalize and incorporate every business life experience I've had into the next level. Most people if they go from one employment situation to another, they drop, unless it's absolutely kindred, they drop all the benefit of the last one, or the last one, or 3 months back. Go back and spend an evening or a day or an afternoon or a weekend reconstructing, really exhuming all the experiences that you have encountered in your adult life, business-wise first, hobby second, everything. You may have it just as an avocation, you may be masterful at raising funds for nonprofit organizations, and maybe that's just been a charitable endeavor you've done, but the truth of the matter is today there are thousands of nonprofit organizations that are dying on the vine because they can't raise funds. Your ability to help them replenish their finances would be an invaluable service that they would probably pay through the nose for. So figure out, what have you done well? What has the implication of that been? What's the universal implication? Who would value and prize that besides whoever you're doing it for now? What would they pay for it? It's a very provocative question, don't you think?
You started out without a whole lot of money, right?
That's true.
Okay.
Also without a whole lot of education.
And you've been very, very successful in marketing your ability to market. And a lot of people have made a lot of money by picking up just bits and pieces of what you've accumulated over the years. And that's a great skill. But let's back up. Tell us a little about how you got into it. How did you begin to perceive that you had this ability? And what were the pressures that forced you to do what you do now? Because obviously nobody could train you to do what you do now, or at least you probably would not have found that person. And if you had, maybe the person would not have told you how to do it.
Here's a chronology here. Number one, I started out in the adult world when I was 18. I got married and had 2 children before I was 20. I had the needs of someone 40 when I was 20, but society didn't care. And I'm not saying that negatively. Actually, it was a wonderful positive development for me. I had very quickly a succession of jobs that were more on the expense side of a business's ledger. I realized quickly that when you were employed on the expense side, unless you could turn it into a profit center for a company, employers would work very hard to keep your compensation down. When you moved to the income-producing side, they didn't much care what they paid you as long as they profited. So I went through a succession of different kinds of jobs, many of which moved from administrative type to or operational to sales or marketing or customer or profit or cash generating. I went through an enormous spectrum of unrelated activities, and something happened after about 20 of them that really made a profound impact, Gary. I realized, because I worked in all kinds of unrelated fields. I was in the chemical field. I was in the financial services field. I was in the mail order field. I was in the real estate field. I was in the association field with the meat packers. I was in the collectible field. I was in the dry cleaning field. I was in the small appliance field. I was in the retail field. I was in the radio and advertising field. And every time I got into a new field, something really fascinating impacted me. I realized that all the things I had learned about in whatever industry I just come from, as far as generating customers, as far as operating approach, as far as selling or marketing or customer building processes, were absolutely not being followed from industry A to B to C. And I realized there was a lot of what I'll call myopia, a lot of tunnel vision. The people only seemed to know what they knew, which they had learned from previous employers in the same field, and it was very incestuous. I was able to take things I had learned from a totally unrelated industry, directly apply them to a different industry, and in a matter of sometimes months, most of the time a year or less, bring the company I was involved with to incredible profit or stature or both, almost eerily, almost almost instantly just by bringing processes and success principles and borrowing them from other industries and applying to mine. So I realized that most people only know what their industry knows. That opened up a massive opportunity for me. I became obsessed with learning everything I could about everybody I could, about every industry I could, about how all kinds of people thought and operated, and migrating or interpreting or applying everything I learned to different people I worked with. And I had a succession of massive, as you know, I've contributed, and I'm very proud of it, to so many multi-million dollar successes and people becoming leaders in the field and turning around businesses and massive profit increases that it almost, I stopped counting. But this all occurred because I was able to consciously utilize what I learned from previous experiences and combine them into hybrids I was able to apply to every new endeavor or employer or client or business situation I found myself in. This is almost the direct opposite of what I have observed most people do.
Which is what are most people, get in one rut and stay?
Most people will do one of two things. There's an old saying, and I'll use it. There's a story. The story goes like this. Man marries a woman. Every year they have Christmas dinner at their house. First thing the woman does is she goes out and buys a big pot roast, and she cuts off both ends of the pot roast, puts it in the pan, cooks it. The man watches this for a couple of years. Finally, after 3 years, he gets curious and says, "Honey, why in the world do you cut off both ends of the pot roast before you bake it?" She says, "Because my mother did it." Coincidentally, her mother and her mother's mother still alive and are at this family's Christmas dinner. He goes up and says, "Mom," to the mother-in-law, "tell me why you cut off the ends of both sides of the pot roast before you made it years ago." And she said, "Well, because that's what my mother did." Make a long story short, he goes to the grandmother, who's old and sitting in a chair, and says, "Grandmother, why in the world did you cut off both ends of the pot roast?"